Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's summer, so it's hot, right? It's supposed to be, but the heat is creeping up on us in ways you may not have noticed. This past June was one of the warmest on record in North Carolina. Charlotte now experiences nearly a month more of extra dangerous, risky heat days every year than it did just 50 years ago in 1976. And by the 2060s, the state predicts we will experience nearly 40 additional days with heat indices exceeding 95 degrees. We're also experiencing a drought, and even the storm on Monday night didn't put a dent in our dry conditions. Last year, the Charlotte Office of Sustainability and Resilience ranked extreme heat as this city's top climate-related threat, and residents have raised heat as a major concern as well. So this hour, a look at what's happening now with climate and weather, what is likely to happen in the future, steps the city is taking to mitigate some of the consequences, and a look at how this affects everything from our tree canopy to you. Zachary Turner is WFAE's climate reporter. He is here along with WCNC-TV Chief Meteorologist Brad Panovich, and Joy Mayo, who represents District 3 on Charlotte City Council, is here. She also serves as Community Engagement Manager for Trees Charlotte, leading efforts to expand our urban tree canopy, but she's here as a city council person. Welcome to all three of you. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Morning, Mike.
We're
morning.
Actually in the same room. This is a red letter day. So, Brad, I'm going to, speaking of red, the thermometer is red. Oh, so let's talk about this. We're not alone in this warming trend. It's happening all over the world. We're watching it happen in Europe. It's going through extreme heat. I read yesterday, and I forgot which publication, some national publication, that cities like Bakersville, California, and a city in Washington State are on a list of soon-to-be desert cities as the climate changes. The Midwest and Northwest have been engulfed in this incredible baking heat wave with torrential rains and flooding. But we've always had summer heat waves. We have always had downpours in the summertime and severe thunderstorms. What makes this different, or is it different?
It's definitely different. I think the common theme that people always say to me is, you know, it's summer, it's supposed to be hot. It's not supposed to be this hot. And it's not supposed to be this hot for this long. There's two things about the heat. Yeah, we get heat waves in the summer, but they're more frequent and they're longer lasting. And the biggest, I think, impact we're seeing here in Charlotte, it's not always those daytime highs where we're getting into the mid-90s. And by the way, we just broke a streak of 6 days in a row of 95-plus when our average high is just 90 degrees. It's already the hottest time of the year, Mike. And when you're 5 to 10 degrees above that, it's really, really hot. But the real problem is the overnight lows. It's not cooling down at night. That's where your air conditioning and your home, and you get to catch up on that daytime heat. We're not getting that chance now. It's barely getting below 80 degrees at night, and that's where the trouble really comes in.
And we're going to talk about that, but we just heard a weather forecast for those of us listening in the morning. We just heard a weather forecast in which they said 95 degrees today for a high with heat indices of 103, and then tonight 75.
Yeah.
So that's more normal. Correct?
It's closer, but it's still 5 degrees above average for this time of year. And that's the 30-year average, which is updated from 10 years ago, which was cooler. So this is above even our modern standards for how hot it is. So those averages are updated every 10 years, and it's a 30-year average. So we updated those back in 2020, and this is above that average. So this even accounts for all the heating of the 2010s. And so you're talking about really hot weather. This is not the heat we had in the 70s, 80s, or even 90s.
Wow. When you were with us a couple of months ago, I think it was May you were here last, and we were talking about hurricanes.
Yes.
And we were talking about La Niñas and El Niños, and last winter was relatively dry, and that was blamed in part to a La Niña, I think.
Correct.
Correct me if I'm wrong. And scientists are predicting a 60 to 70% chance that we're heading into the opposite.
Yes.
An El Niño by summer or late summer. Have we gotten, is it in place yet?
We just officially went into El Niño in the middle of the summer here, and it's only going to get worse as we go into the fall. This is what you may have seen, super El Niño. I don't like that term because it's really not a term we use. It's one of the strongest El Niños possible. maybe three degrees Celsius above average plus. I mean, some of the
be American. What does that mean?
So we're talking about water in the equatorial Pacific. So we look at this region in the eastern equatorial Pacific, and when the temperature is a degree or even a half degree above or below, we get into El Nino, La Nina. We're talking like double, triple that above.
So 3 degrees Celsius
yes.
equates to what Fahrenheit?
Roughly about 10 degrees.
That's a lot. See, the Celsius scale is... There's not enough numbers.
It's funny. It's like I'm a big metric person, but I do like Fahrenheit because there's more numbers in it. And it's actually a little bit more specific.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, you talked about this super El Nino, and scientists are saying that they are anticipating the emergence of that, even though you don't like the term. And this would be among, as I understand it, the stronger events on record with what they call dire implications worldwide. What would those implications be?
To be quite honest and frank, we don't really know. And I think that's what has a lot of scientists and meteorologists worried, because some of the strongest El Niños in the past have created widespread flooding events, created droughts in other parts of the world. For us, it's usually a lot of wet and cool weather in the cool season. But because it's so strong, we don't know the implications. And there's other climate factors that weren't around the last time we had an El Niño this strong. We have lower sea ice in the Arctic. And that all plays into a factor of like the unknown of how this could affect the global weather cycles and climate cycles.
And we probably talked about this before, because when I was growing up as a kid, I don't remember any weatherman on television ever saying the words El Niño or La Niña.
Yeah.
Why are we talking about it now?
I think because we know more, but also it's the broadcast industry's changed quite a bit. When I was growing up,
we have real meteorologists.
There's real meteorologists on TV now. I mean, to be honest, that's part of the reason I never wanted to go into broadcasting when I was coming to school, because I'm like, these aren't real scientists. But that has changed dramatically. We have real scientists now on the air, and we're able to talk about these things, and people are more receptive to learning about why the weather and climate is doing what it's doing.
And I read yesterday that weather scientists or scientists who are concerned about this super El Nino are concerned about it because even though we've had these in the past, we have not had them when the weather was already warmer than it should be.
Exactly.
And ocean surface temperatures were already warmer than they should be.
Yeah.
So you put that on undergirding all of the super Nino effects.
Yeah.
And they don't know what's coming.
Yeah, and that's a big issue. We use things called teleconnections to kind of forecast long range. Mm-hmm. Like I'd use it for my winter forecast. And most of those teleconnections were based on the Arctic being a certain way in the past, or monsoonal rains in Africa being a certain way. Those have all changed. So some of those metrics we've used in the past, we can't use in the future because everything has changed. That we don't have the same type of Arctic ocean. We don't have the same type of sea surface temperatures. Year round now, the ocean is always warm. It's not cooling down in the wintertime. And that just changes all the dynamics for your forecast.
Is this all happening much faster than scientists predicted?
In some cases, yes, and in ways that we probably didn't even foresee in the future, because a lot of the warming of the climate is actually being pushed into the ocean. Mm-hmm. And the ocean is kind of like, it's been like our saving grace. It's actually, we probably would be a lot warmer in the atmosphere if it wasn't for the ocean absorbing a lot of this heat. And it's not only shallow warm water, which is a concern. This is deep warm water. It's getting deeper. This is affecting a lot of marine life as well, because there's no cool water for some of these species to go to now. And it's really having a big impact on the wildlife as well.
Wow. Have we reached a point of no return? Can this be reversed in any way or slowed
down? I would say no.
It can
always be reversed, but it's the time scales of how long it takes to reverse these. I mean, this is not, if we cut off all CO2 right now, it would be centuries before this warming could be removed. We're basically just trying to slow it down at this point, or get it back to like not an increasing level of warming.
I know that Brad, as a meteorologist, talks about the weather, and the weather and climate are different, although they're interconnected in many ways. Zach, but you talk to people as a climate reporter all the time, scientists and others who study this. How alarmed are they about all of this?
I would say the people that are feeling it the most vulnerable people in Charlotte right now are mainly concerned about keeping themselves cool. They're really worried about their energy bills, trying to keep bills down. The folks that I've talked to, I texted a couple of my sources that I know deal with a lot of energy burden, and it's tough. The heat is unbearable, but they're struggling with these hard decisions about whether or not to turn on the AC, get right. that relief, help their body alleviate some of that stress. But at the same time, this, what we're experiencing right now, is kind of the prelude to a lot of those electrical disconnections we're going to experience in the early fall. People getting cut off from power because they can't keep up with their energy bills. And this is a cohort of people that are just getting back on their feet after our two winter storms in January. You know, we had a lot of people that were struggling. They're going to places like Crisis Assistance Ministry here in Charlotte to get those one-time energy payments right. to try and get back on top of their bills. And now they're getting hit with this early summer heat wave, and they're going to be kind of right back in that hole.
We're going to talk a lot about that as we go through the hour here, but you recently wrote an article about how climate change is affecting the Carolinas, and you quoted Yale University's 2024 climate opinion map. I've never heard of this before. Didn't know you could have an opinion, but okay. It shows that although many people here worry about climate change, they rarely talk about it, and even fewer than half believe that it will personally affect them. How can that be when we're living through a drought and we're living through extremely hot temperatures and higher energy bills, and we're living through seaside homes falling into the ocean because of surf eroding the beaches because of rising sea levels and rising homeowner insurance rates? How can you say it doesn't affect you? What is wrong with these people?
I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with people. I think there are a million reasons why people don't necessarily connect what they're experiencing right now to our changing climate. One of them is probably this kind of, I don't know if I'd call it a myth, or just this belief that what we're experiencing right now is normal. Mm-hmm. People have this feeling that it's always been hot and humid in North Carolina, and it has, but not to this degree. We're not used to this many risky heat days, and we're not used to these crazy overnight highs.
So it's really, it is what I said in the beginning. Yeah. It's creeping up on us. It's like being the frog in the boiling pot of water.
Absolutely. 100%. And the other thing is our technology and our way of life here has made it easier for us to adapt, and we don't notice as much. I mean, think about this weather occurring in like the 1940s or the 1930s with not the amount of infrastructure, AC, electricity, insulation. That it would be unlivable in some of these areas.
I will push back and say that there are people right now in Charlotte that are experiencing it in that way. There are people that don't have air conditioning in their home or can't afford to even run it. And I think that's a big issue, is that even people that maybe have AC, there's a huge issue with people living in homes that are using electricity or that air conditioning inefficiently. You know, they just spend a lot of money cooling their house just to have all of that cool air escape out of like a hole in their roof.
And that is partly why Joy Mayo is here. Joy Mayo is City Council District 3, and she also works with Trees Charlotte. Last November, Joy, Zach reported that on the candidates running for public office, including you in Charlotte, and said that not all candidates said they were aware that fossil fuels are the primary cause of global warming. Most agreed that Charlatteans would experience, however, the effects of climate change in their lifetime, and that decisions made by local leaders could affect that. Some of the primary drivers in your campaign to be on city council were commitments to focus on the tree canopy, restoration, extreme heat, and energy consumption. I know you haven't been on council all that long, but have you been able to chip away at any of that, and what kind of support are you getting from fellow council members?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're thinking through quite a few things, particularly with our CAP, our Strategic Energy Action Plan, that the city already has implemented. I think that's so important that we're thinking through strategies.
I have thrown you a curve because because we are going to a break, and I'll let you answer that question in a fuller manner when we come back from
that break.
I apologize for
that.
Joy Mayo is here with Brad Panovich and Zachary Turner. It's WFAE Charlotte.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte, celebrating 95 years of impact in the Carolinas, strengthening nonprofits, neighborhoods, and people through the support of charitable contributions. More at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins here. We're here with the WCNC-TV Chief meteorologist Brad Panovich. Zach Turner is with us. Zachary Turner is our climate reporter here at WFAE. And Joy Mayo is joining us, City Council District 6, District 3, Council member. And I threw you a curveball by asking you a question that was impossible to answer in the time allotted. So let me repeat the question and give you a better chance to answer it. One of the things that you ran on to become a member of council was tree canopy restoration, extreme heat problems, and energy consumption, which is related, I guess, in many ways to heat and cold because people run their furnaces and their air conditioners. Have you been able to chip away at it, and have other council members been supportive? Are they on the same page?
Yeah, I think if you're kind of watching the city council meetings, which I know are long and tedious, particularly if you're watching some of the rezonings, you're seeing some of the conversations I'm having, thinking through undisturbed buffers for existing areas. I think that's really important, that instead of just, you know, clear-cutting areas and then we're putting trees back, it could take 30, 40 years for those trees to grow the size of the current canopy in some of those areas. So I've been really kind of challenging developers to think through how do we keep, have better tree saves.
Do they care?
They do, yeah. I think they do. I mean, it is contingent on getting our vote. So, I mean, I think, you know, we have a bit of leverage, and I think it's important that we're thinking through the future.
Because this used to be the city of trees. The city used to have a tree in its logo. It was on the side of all the buses. That's been taken out. And the tree canopy at one point was disappearing, I think, at the rate of one or two or three football fields a day. Have we slowed that down? Have we stopped it?
No, not really. The city had a goal of reaching a 50% tree canopy by 2050. Last study, canopy study that we did, we were about 47% tree canopy. We're kind of saying if we continue business as usual, in the next couple years, we're going to be about like 40%. And that's devastating for people when that is something people talk about a lot when they come to Charlotte, particularly when you're flying over, just seeing the beautiful tree canopy that we have. I'm hoping that soon the city is going to kind of move away from the 50 by 2050 because I think we need to be more equity-based.
The 50 is what, 50%?
50% tree canopy by 2050.
Okay.
I'm just thinking through, there are places in Charlotte that already have a 50% tree canopy. Mm-hmm. You're going to Ballantyne or Myers Park, or more of our more affluent areas in Charlotte, they already have a 50% tree canopy. Whereas some of our areas, West Charlotte, East Charlotte, that have been historically underserved, do not have that.
Which came first, the chicken or the egg here? Since Ballantyne and Myers Park have a greater tree canopy and it's a more affluent area, is it more affluent because more affluent people want to live under the tree canopy, or because they put those trees in because that's what more affluent people want, therefore we're going to give it to them? I mean, we didn't give it to people who are less affluent.
I mean, I think some of that goes back to redlining when we're thinking about how different people in the city have been able to purchase homes in different areas. Also thinking through the highway expansion. I know we talked a lot about 77 South for months, and I'm sure we'll continue to have that conversation after the budget. But those highways are going through black and brown communities, which make it even more hot because of asphalt, kind of creating that heat island effect. So, because, I mean, it's exacerbating.
Because the tree canopy in Myers Park was not always there. It used to be a farm.
True.
A long, long time ago. But when they built that, it was built by, I think, the guy who designed Central Park in New York, which has trees in it. What do you know? They planted those trees. And it takes a long time for those kinds of trees to reach the canopy that they have now. But you're not just talking about beauty when you talk about the desirability of the tree canopy. You're talking about what it does.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely helps with cooling. So, I mean, that's a big part of what I'm excited that the city is doing. We just got a grant for $1.2 million so that we can add trees, street trees, for people. So when you're going to Myers Park, that's something you notice, like the big white oaks on, you know, by so close to the road. That helps cool the area down by almost 10 degrees. But when you're going to other areas, you're not seeing that, particularly in parts of District 3. So I think, one, reminding people that the city does have a program where you can have street trees added that are going to help you with your electric bill in the future. I mean, it may not be your near future, but hopefully your children's. We always say it would have been better to have planted a tree, you know, 20 years ago. So
There is a Georgia Tech professor who believes that we need to think about trees in the same way we think about infrastructure. In fact, he thinks that trees are infrastructure because of the exact same thing that you're talking about. He says that we should be thinking about tree placement and putting them along streets and sidewalks. Charlotte is doing that. You just got a grant to do this.
Yeah, we just got a grant about in May. So we actually, our city's landscape management department actually hired a consultant firm. They're actually hit boots on the ground, walking around, particularly in our corridors of opportunity where we know, you know, people have maybe not had some of the opportunities. Also, the city does a great job of maintaining our existing street trees. So that's something that they're in charge of as well. But we have a goal of adding 800 trees this year, street trees. So it's an ambitious goal, but I think that we can reach that. And I think it's a great opportunity. I hope that any listeners who would like a street tree added will really think through that. And even trees in the medians, those are things that if you were to go out and buy a tree, you can't generally put a tree there because you know, it's one of those burlap trees are super, super big, large, and expensive to kind of move there.
So. Okay. There are a lot of aspects to what we're talking about this morning, about the rising temperatures, et cetera, Zach. But one of the things is something called heat stress, which I never heard about before yesterday. It's the leading cause of weather-related deaths, and the number of people experiencing heat stress has increased exponentially, evidently, around the world in just the last several decades because of what we've been talking about with Brad. So what exactly is heat stress?
I mean, heat stress itself, I guess, is not necessarily a condition. It's just over time as you're experiencing high temperatures, starts to wear down your body. It becomes harder and harder for you to kind of conduct homeostasis, that process of, you know, sweating and cooling yourself down. And that can lead to a number of different types of illnesses. It can also exacerbate pre-existing conditions. There was a pulmonary cardiologist that was giving a talk yesterday, and he was raising the alarm bell. I mean, he wasn't a climate scientist, but he was saying this is not normal. Every year, the summer is the hardest time for his patients, and now they're struggling more than ever just being able to breathe because of that heat stress.
Do most of those people not have access to air conditioning, or these people who have access to air conditioning but just going outside for brief amounts of time stresses them to the point where they can't cope?
It's just going about their day. Anytime they have to go outside, I imagine for folks without air conditioning, that's even worse.
Wow.
But yeah, with air conditioning, they're still feeling that stress anytime they have to leave their home.
Joy.
Yeah, definitely would like to kind of echo that point that Zach had. I used to be a teacher before I started working for an environmental nonprofit, and I had a student who actually could not go outside in the spring, even just to walk to the cafeteria because of the heat would exacerbate his asthma. Mm-hmm. So I just want to kind of talk through how that is just such a huge problem. I know the city last year gave away 100 AC units for residents, vulnerable residents. This year, we've already given out 50, and we'll be giving out about 50 more. So if there are residents in need, I definitely hope that they'll contact our housing and neighborhood services team so that we can provide ACs.
The relief used to be at night when the temperatures dropped
because
the sun wasn't shining. And that's, as you said, Brad, that is not happening as frequently. And in fact, the nights are getting warmer. And scientists analyzed a global data set of human heat stress from 1950 to 2024 and found that the 10 warmest nights of each year warmed faster than the 10 warmest days, which means heat stress is increasing in duration and frequency and et cetera. But why would the nights when the sun isn't shining, why would they be getting warmer? Why?
We're noticing that big time here in Charlotte. Most of our heating is happening during the nighttime hours. And there's a side effect of a warming atmosphere. It holds more moisture. So the humidity stays higher. When there's more humidity, you can't radiate that heat out at night. So the air retains that heat during the overnight hours. So it's not just the urban heat island, which is a big issue in Charlotte. Our rapid development is creating this issue where we're retaining heat because of the pavement, the asphalt, the trees, the lack of trees, the concrete, the rooftops. But we also have higher humidity levels. The dew points we're seeing now are almost unprecedented at night, and that's helping retain the heat in the air as well. So we have this double whammy of all these heat-absorbing surfaces, and then the air itself is actually holding the heat longer at night as well.
This obviously leads, as Zach said, this leads to health implications, Joy. And it sounds like, and maybe this is a bit why people don't think it affects them, because most of us, I would think the plurality of us, have access to air conditioning.
Exactly.
So we're not noticing. We're sitting here in a very comfortable studio.
Yeah.
And outside, it's not. It's hot. So they don't notice it as much. And it's so when we talk about this, it sounds like a third world problem. But it is not a third world problem. It's happening right here.
Well, I don't know about y'all, but I've been primarily staying in the house if it's, unless it's the morning or the evening, because, I mean, it's pretty hot for me. But, I mean, I think through the city, we're really trying to think of some different strategies. Really excited about our naturalistic landscaping program that we have. We just passed an ordinance. People don't think about pollinator gardens and naturalistic landscapes opposed to turf actually helps with cooling. So, I mean, I think all across the board, we're going to have to think differently as regular homeowners, as developers. Like, how can we all do our part to help our neighbors? Even if maybe I'm not having issues with AC, well, if I were able to absorb more of that heat, that could help my neighbors.
And you see this as an environmental justice issue.
I do.
Talk about that. And, yeah. And Zach, you can jump in here, too. I know you wanted to.
Go ahead. I mean, I think there's a huge issue, particularly in Black and brown communities, when you're talking about East and West Charlotte, who already are having to deal with industrial complexes in their neighborhood, just because of, I would just say, systemic racism, if I'm just being completely honest and frank. And then the fact that it costs money to maintain trees, I mean, thousands of dollars. And the city received a grant maybe 2 or 3 years ago, but because of our current administration, some of that was taken away. And that was to help residents to maintain trees.
Because because it's not just the city taking care of the trees in the rights of way, where they own the property. If you have a homeowner with a tree and they are a low-income homeowner and the tree has problems, I've had to take a tree out, and it cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
So what we're kind of between a rock and a hard place for some of these people. They need the tree to cool, and yet the tree is rotten and needs to be taken down. So what do we do about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're thinking through some different strategies. We have our canopy care program that the city of Charlotte has as well that I think is really – we're using some of that money that we're getting from developers who are clear cutting or – you know, maybe they're doing something and they're not maybe putting as much tree save back.
Mm-hmm.
You're having to pay a fine, pretty much. And we're using that fine then to help residents who maybe wouldn't be able to take care of their existing trees. But, I mean, I think that's something we need to really explore in more detail because, I mean, I receive calls all the time in my day job about this exact issue. Seniors who are calling saying, you know, I have this big tree. I'm afraid. I'm watching it sway. And I understand. I see that at my house sometimes. So I'm like, awkward, scary. And, you know, that's scary for our seniors as well if they're on fixed income to have to come out of pocket when they're thinking through AC bills and medicine.
Zachary, when I brought up social justice, you wanted to jump in there, I think.
Well, I was just going back to what you were saying about this feeling like a problem that's happening somewhere else. In North Carolina, we see hundreds of people. During the summer, we see hundreds of people going to emergency departments every week. Because of heat-related illness. The first week, or I think it was the second week of June, was particularly bad. Over 500 people across the state ended up going to visit the emergency department because of these heat-related illnesses. So it is something that is happening in the state. It's happening in our communities.
Brad, we're taking these measures to put trees in, and we're trying to preserve our tree canopy, and we're trying to expand green space because it's cooler where trees are. It's cooler where there's green space as opposed to concrete pavement and sidewalks and skyscrapers in the downtown, which we have because we have this urban heat island effect.
Yes.
But can we make a dent in what's going on around the world by simply having more trees and more green space?
Oh, I absolutely believe so. Trees
really?
Are like the probably the best way to fight all of this because two of the biggest climate impacts we have here in Charlotte, we're talking about heat now, but I would say the second one is extreme rainfall events. And this is very true for Charlotte. And they're somewhat connected, especially because of our development. that the impervious surfaces are also the same thing that creates the urban heat island,
right,
creates rapid runoff. The trees solve two problems here. They cool us down. They also slow down runoff from heavy rainfall events. So the tree has this great impact to help reduce two of the biggest things we see from climate change in our warming climate, which is the heat and the extreme rainfall events. And I think if we had more trees, you would reduce that. You're also pulling, they're sinks for CO2. They pull carbon dioxide out of the air. It's the biggest drain we can use. I mean, the Amazon rainforest is one of the biggest sinks for carbon dioxide in the world. And if we had more trees, we could pull more of that out of the atmosphere.
I will push back and say, like, just not that trees don't do all those things. They definitely do. But they do less of that immediately. I guess if you're, when you plant a tree, I'm thinking about the little trees that we have on North Davidson Street, not providing a lot of shade. It's still very, very, very warm, very, very hot when I'm walking to the coffee shop. And I took a little
iced coffee.
Coffee, a little Americano, a little splash of oat milk. While I was walking around with that, I had my infrared heat sensor. And those sidewalks, those asphalts, they're getting hot. They're getting up to 120, 130 degrees. So these are, planting trees right now is a great solution, especially for people that are in those in a situation where they have air conditioning. But for people right now that need immediate relief, we have some programs that could use strengthening that focus on improving energy efficiency so that people are getting, you know, AC units into those homes so that they can run AC or they can afford to run AC, or when they do use those technologies, they're being used efficiently and their home is staying cool and stuff that provides immediately relief like that.
I want to come back to the temperatures in a second. Joy, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk. I know random a lot of programs about the city, funny enough. But All Our Eyes, we also have a solarized program right now that we're helping underserved residents actually be able to put solar panels on their home. So how are we helping people get out of the power grid? I mean, we just saw maybe last week, D.C. was having rolling blackouts. Yeah. Like, I can't imagine dealing with that right now, not having AC. So how do we get more people from pulling from the grid? And that's something that the city's working through, having like a carbon neutral goal for 2030, thinking through how are we creating electric fire stations? How are we thinking for the future? Because things are getting rough out there.
Last week during the real heat wave, and I guess the news cycle was slow because it was a holiday week, there were a lot of reporters on the national news with those thermometers that they pointed at the it's 98 degrees outside, but let me point this at the pavement.
That was me last week. Well,
they came, you win the thing because you came up with the highest temperature that I've seen so far. And that was 140 degrees in NOTA on Thursday afternoon. We're going to come back to that in just a couple of seconds and talk more about Charlotte being an urban heat island and what that means. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the climate, the heat, stuff that surrounds all of that, particularly in the modern environment, with Brad Panovich, chief meteorologist at WCNC-TV. Joy Mayo is City Council District 3 representative, and Zachary Turner is our climate reporter at WFAE News. And I mentioned that last week you went out with a thermometer in NOTA and measured the temperature in various areas, and you win the sweepstakes because of all the reporters all over the country that I saw doing this on television, you had the highest temperature, 140 degrees. But that did depend on where you were, and I was going to ask you if it was cooler in grassier, tree-covered areas, but you said you also went to Freedom Park, and the grass was warmer than you thought it was going to be.
Yeah, I mean, this was not an exhaustive study on my part. I was going around with my I know. I was getting some flack from my partner too when I was going out. She was saying, like, you know, it's like, you know, just because you get one reading this time doesn't mean like you can't draw some conclusions from that. And I was like, oh, no. Put that in the article. I mean, where you live is going to have a huge impact on how you're experiencing this heat wave. If you live along the light rail corridor, if you live at the intersection of two large highways, then those things are going to store up heat during the day like a giant concrete battery. And then they're going to slowly release that heat during the night, keeping temperatures elevated in your area. I saw this on North Brevard Street. I went out at 10 p.m. at night. I was in my pajamas with my thermometer, and I was shooting the pavement with it, and it was still 93 degrees even at 10 p.m. at night. I went back in the morning, 7 a.m. before the sun had touched the pavement, and it was about 87. So it's slowly discharging those degrees back up into the kind of immediate atmosphere.
So we have this urban heat island effect in most cities, and we certainly have it in Charlotte. And quite often, we see these really severe thunderstorms moving in a line toward Charlotte.
Yeah.
A diagonal line from northeast to southwest, and it's going toward the east.
Yep.
And many times it just circumvents Charlotte. We don't get
it. It feels like it, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Is that because the heat radiating off?
Not really. A lot of that is because the mountains are creating what's called the Lee Trough. So that's usually a mountain-derived phenomenon. But what happens with urban heat islands, usually downwind of the urban heat island, we see thunderstorms develop. There's been a lot of research in the University of Georgia. My good friend Dr. Marshall Shepard has done this, where just Lee of Atlanta, they've seen big storms form just downwind because the heat of the city creates the updraft that then produces a thunderstorm. But that thunderstorm doesn't form over Charlotte. It forms downwind. So usually down in Union County or Cabarrus County or somewhere else, it doesn't form in Charlotte.
A couple of years ago, Charlotte produced, or somebody in Charlotte produced, Zachary, a heat map of the city. It kind of, when I looked at it yesterday, it kind of looks like one of those lines of thunderstorms coming through diagonally once again from northeast to southwest. Yeah. And there's this big red line that runs in that direction through the center of uptown. Yeah. What else did it show? What did we learn from that heat map?
Well, we learned that neighborhoods like Noda and South End, also uptown, are incredibly hot. And those big intersections like Freedom Drive and Scott Futrell are warmer than the surrounding areas. Mm-hmm. And then we see that like the more affluent areas, Myers Park, and then also parks and nature preserves, those are much cooler. And that's kind of, there's kind of like a, I don't know if it's a double-edged sword or what, when you're looking at that light rail corridor and you're seeing it so hot, you have this infrastructure that is in place, this public transportation that's supposed to help people move away from using fossil fuels. It's supposed to help people kind of stop contributing to this problem. But as it gets hotter and hotter, as long as we have all of this built infrastructure, this concrete surrounding it, it becomes harder and harder for people to use because it's so hot and people need these shady corridors to be able to access this without grilling in the heat while they wait for public transportation.
So you spoke with Catherine Idziorek, I hope I said her name correctly, a professor of urban design at UNC Charlotte, who led that heat mapping project. And I read it, what she had to say, three times, and I'm not sure I understand it. So so I'm going to ask you to explain it to me, because she said that she told you that she expected to see more of a correlation of higher temperatures in areas in which underinvestment historically occurred, i.e. west side of Charlotte. She thought it would be hotter in the areas we refer to as the Crescent, which is from, I guess, East Charlotte through the west side of town, and which is composed mostly of lower-income, non-white residents. But what she found was that Charlotte was pretty much hot everywhere, despite warmer pockets here and there. So am I getting this right, that she says we're just hot?
We're just hot. We are hot, but it's like degrees of hot. I mean, in general, this is especially apparent in like the morning hours, where you're going to see the greatest difference between an urban area like Charlotte and a more rural area. I think they used Wadesboro as sort of their control. And then the morning, we're like 10 degrees hotter than some of our rural counterparts.
Same true in Raleigh, same true in Greensboro, same true in Durham, would it be true?
I would imagine it would be similar. Yeah. I don't know if it's exactly like, you know, that 10 degrees difference, but, you know, wherever you're going to see more concentrated built environment, parking lots, roads, roofs, all of this stuff, you're going to start to see that difference between the urban and the rural in terms of heat retention.
Are we the warmest city in the Carolinas because we want to be number one?
Oh, yeah. Well, we are just because of our urban footprint. I mean,
warmer than Columbia?
Well, not Columbia. I mean, that's really hot. Or Fayetteville, you know. But those are smaller. That's different because of soil types and other things there. That has more to do with that than just our urban corridor. But yeah, I mean, part of the problem is we love development here, but it's also a double-edged sword where that's what creates a lot of the heat, the runoff. I would imagine in some of these areas where there's a lot of rapid development with big parking lots, I mean, even in suburban areas, you know, you got giant shopping centers with giant parking lots, that creates a lot of heat. And so if we're not putting, you know, green space in and around there, planting trees, green, I mean, there's even like out west, you know, seen this in Phoenix, they're starting to paint roofs white, right? You know, and this, that you think that's the silly thing, but it has a big impact.
Yes. Why aren't they white?
Rooftop gardens. I mean, green space on top of buildings. This has a huge impact. And these are things that we could do now to help reduce some of this heating.
Which leads me to a question from one of our listeners, Melanie in East Charlotte. Please ask if we can educate homeowners and rental owners not to cut down huge old trees so they can park cars and trucks. I live in East Charlotte, and in my neighborhood, we have lost so many old, huge trees. Joy.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I hope that people are being very careful with that. You know, the Unified Development Ordinance, or UDO, if there a tree is a heritage tree and you don't have a permit to cut that, you could get a huge fine.
How do you how do you know you have a heritage tree?
It's like DBI, so the diameter at breast height. If you were kind of to take the tree and wrap around to see like the size of it, I think it's over 30 inches is like the category. But I mean, you could report your neighbors, Melanie. Not, I mean, you don't have to, but you could if you're seeing someone doing that. And I think that's where the city is getting the most complaints from neighbors telling on each other. But I mean, I think we have to go back to old school. Everyone has to hold each other accountable. I mean, I know back in the day, our parents talked about if you got in trouble at school, you know, you got in trouble walking down the street, your neighbors heard about it, like you heard it from everybody. We need to go back to that and hold people accountable.
Speaking of reporting on your neighbors.
Sorry.
We have a drought in Charlotte, and evidently we can only water our lawns on certain days of the week and certain times, and you're not allowed to wash your car in the driveway because that evidently consumes more water than it would be if you took it to a car wash because car washes allegedly recycle their water. At one point this summer, Brad, almost the entire state was in a drought.
Yeah.
And I think Charlotte was in a
exceptional
drought.
Yeah.
We are no longer in exceptional drought, are we?
We're still in severe to moderate drought.
So what is the difference between exceptional and severe to moderate?
It's the
extreme.
It's the impacts that it's having, you know, soil moisture, stream flows, crop stress. But we're still there's no debate that we're in a severe drought still for most of the state because our water supply is still very impacted right now, which is the Catawba Basin. And this just goes to show you how interconnected we are. Mm-hmm. It's not rain in Charlotte that helps our water supply. It's rain up in Burke County, Catawba County, up in the foothills and the mountains. That's the watershed for the Catawba Basin. If it doesn't rain up there, guess what? Charlotte doesn't get water in the Catawba River for us to drink out of. So that's why water restrictions are still really, really important. Because if you haven't been to Lake Norman or Lake Wylie or even the Catawba River, that water level is really, really low.
But there are fines for breaking the rules I just referred to, Joy. And I read in the Charlotte Observer, I think it was this morning, that so far people are pretty much following the rules. There have been people who have been fined, but not as many as you might think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are people still kind of breaking the rules and they need to have conversations with them. But I mean, I think overall, I'm hoping that people are really being thoughtful. And, you know, we want to be able to turn our faucet on and there be water. So we all need to do our part and be thoughtful.
Yeah, I'm seeing about 270 violations so far reported for the city.
And people don't, we've talked about this before on the show. That's why I bring it up again. When you turn the light switch on, you're using water.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Very true. And I would just say this. I mean, we do have water restrictions, but they're really not that restrictive.
No, they're not.
I mean, actually, this is the way we should have been watering all the time. People overwater in Charlotte, and they water in the middle of the day when 50 to 60% of that water gets lost to evaporate. It's inefficient. You shouldn't be watering during the day, even when we're not in water restrictions. So to water twice a week is actually just fine.
Yeah.
If you water deep and do it twice a week. That's all your plants need.
Early morning before the sun rises.
Yeah, 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. is great. So I would just say, you know, it's really not that restrictive. And if everybody follows this, we'll be okay.
So on Monday night, most of us, I didn't get to sleep till like 2:30 in the morning on Monday
night. Like me, Mike.
Because it was thundering and lightning and it was raining blue blazes. And I thought, well, That's that's the end of the drought.
That's the drought, right? Yeah. And, that's what most people think.
We have a weather underground weather station on my street, so I checked, and we had 1.9 inches of rain that night. So that's
there were higher amounts, too.
Yeah, there were higher amounts.
Yeah.
But that did not put a dent in the drought, did it?
Mike, I was up that same time, too, and I heard all that thunder and saw it. Guess how much rain I got at my house?
Like
a big goose egg. Zero.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah. Now, Uptown got about 3 inches. Reedy Creek got about 3 inches.
Wow.
There were parts of Charlotte, but there were parts of North Charlotte and South Charlotte that did not get a single drop of rain. Mm. That's just the nature of these summer and afternoon and evening thunderstorms. That was a nighttime storm. But for us to get out of a drought, it's about consistency, persistency, and expansion of the rain. Mm. Well, rain in one part of Mecklenburg County doesn't end the drought. It waters the lawns and gardens in that part of town, and everybody else stays dry. We need widespread rain. So we can't get out of droughts with pop-up afternoon storms. Mm. It just doesn't work out very well. We need big systems like cold fronts, low-pressure systems, and I hate to say this, a tropical system.
That's where I was going there.
That hopefully is not severe, but soaks us across here.
Hurricanes are good for ending droughts.
30% of our annual rainfall in the Southeast comes from tropical
systems. And yet we're in this El Nino, and as I understand it,
that reduces tropical systems.
In the Atlantic.
Yeah, at least in the summer. Now, the El Nino couldn't end up helping us out in the fall and winter, but in the summer, it doesn't tend to help us out in a drought situation.
Have we had? I tried to think about this yesterday, and I could have looked it up, I suppose, but I thought, no, Brad's coming. Have we had a significant tropical storm? Have we had?
We had Arthur, but it caused flooding in parts of Texas and Louisiana, but we haven't had a big system.
So we're only on the A's?
Yeah, only on A. And so
is that normal for this time?
We're not too far. We're starting to lag a little bit behind. We should be, I think it's actually the 11th Saturday, we should be on the B or C storm by then. So we're getting to the point where we should start to see them. But two things are happening: El Nino and Sahara air layer. The dust coming off of Africa is creating a hostile environment for tropical systems. So there's been almost nothing in the Atlantic. Now, the Pacific, the opposite. We just had Super Typhoon Bavi go through Guam and head towards Southeast Asia. And that was a super typhoon with 180 mile per hour winds, because all the warm water in the Pacific creates a great atmosphere for hurricanes. But in the Atlantic, El Nino creates wind shear, which reduces it. We still have warm water, but we'd have wind shear. That just goes to show you there's two ingredients we need for hurricanes.
Joy, you talked about trees in more affluent areas, including Myers Park. But one of the problems with the trees in these more affluent areas, like Myers Park, is that those trees are old.
Yeah.
And they're aging out. And I'm wondering what the stress of drought is having on those trees. Do we know?
I don't know that. I know from my day job, we actually do go back and look at the tree species that we've been planting over the years, and we're actually starting to track that. And I think that's really important for us to be thoughtful of what trees we're planting in the future. So I'm hoping that the city and different organizations are sharing that data. But you're completely right, particularly in Myers Park with those white oaks. They are aging out. They're nearing the end of their lifespan. Mm-hmm. So how are we thinking about succession planning is something that we really need to be talking about as well.
Okay. We have another question from a listener email. Nancy, why, oh why, are our leaders not talking about the cause of the climate crisis, fossil fuels, and how we can reduce them and how we can increase our clean energy sources? This is from the mother founder of Clean Air and Sea.
Are we talking about June or are we talking about
Nancy?
Sorry, Nancy.
Yeah.
So now...
Okay.
have scientists, I'm going to ask a stupid question, and I know what the answer is, I'm still going to ask it. Have scientists concluded, up to nearly 100%, that fossil fuels are the cause of all this?
Oh, we're at like 99.999%. It's about as close as you're going to get.
So why are we still advocating for drill, baby, drill?
It's a good question. And it not only is it a question from a climate, it's also an economic question, because so many other sources of renewable energies are cheaper than fossil fuels and easier to get to market and quicker than some of these other
sources.
The
answer is money, Brad. El Nino, whether it takes shape as a super El Nino or not, is going to keep hurricanes at bay probably. But some forecasters say this portends wetter than normal conditions in the winter.
Yeah.
Is that the silver lining in all of this?
So I'm hoping, Mike, but I would tell you, I'm not a big absolutes on this because I would say there's a 75 to 80% probability of above average rainfall for the cool season, which is what we consider fall, winter, and spring, and above average rainfall. But the problem is there's that 25% chance where it may not. Not every El Nino is the same. And right. This one being so strong is one that's going to be hard to forecast.
The real question was, is it going to snow?
But that's always the question.
That's a question for a later day. Brad Panovich is chief meteorologist at WCNC-TV, Joy Mayo, City Council District 3 representative, and Zachary Turner with us, our climate reporter here at WFAE News. Thank you all for being here, and thank you all for the hour.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Our intern is Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.